Section 2. The Native People Discovered. As you read, look for tribes that lived in early North Carolina, the culture of the woodland people, how contact with Europeans affected Native American life, and the following terms: dialect, clan, matrilineal, Columbian exchange, and immunity. You may know the children's rhyme, "In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue." It's true. Christopher Columbus, the famous Italian explorer, sailed from Spain across the Atlantic Ocean in 1492. While he was searching for an improved route to trade with Asia, he had no idea that North and South America were in his way. What followed Columbus's voyages was a rapid increase in exploration from Europe to the West. As the explorers ventured into the area that we know as the Carolinas, they found people living on the land. From the explorers' point of view, these lands were a new world, full of strange animals, plants, and people. For the native people, these lands were their home, and the light-skinned Europeans were the strange ones. With their large boats, peculiar animals, and powerful weapons, the Europeans represented both a curiosity and a threat. The native cultures that would play important roles in the history of North Carolina had been well organized by the 1500s. Most were renamed by the Europeans who first encountered them, but the groups had developed customs and values that withstood many of the problems that came with European contact. The same basic groups still live in North Carolina in the early 21st century. Archaeologists think that more than 30 different groups lived on the coastal plain, Piedmont, and mountains in the 1500s. Some were no larger than one or two villages, like the Eno, who gave their name to a river near Durham. Other nations numbered in the thousands, the largest being the Cherokee in the westernmost mountains. Algonquin tribes. Along the coast lived small groups that spoke various versions of the Algonquin language. This particular language was shared by villages and tribes all along the Atlantic coast, from what is today Maine down to North Carolina. These groups included the Chowanoc and Pasquotank, who lived north of the Albemarle Sound, each of whom was the namesake for a county. One Chowanoc village had more than 1,000 people in the late 1500s. The Waccamaw, the largest group on the Cape Fear, gave their name to Lake Waccamaw, one of the largest of the Carolina Bay lakes, and to the Waccamaw River. Like all native peoples, these groups took particular advantage of their environment, depending heavily on fish taken from the sea and sounds. In addition, reported Arthur Barlow, a visiting Englishman in the 1500s, they ate many kinds of fruits, melons, walnuts, cucumbers, gourds, peas, and diverse roots. It was also said that their corn was very white, fair, and well-tasted. The Algonquin were the subjects of the famous watercolor paintings done by John White of the Lost Colony. The Tuscarora. The coastal plain was dominated in the 1500s by one tribe, the Tuscarora. This group had about 15 large villages, each with about 300 to 500 people, concentrated near the Neuse and Tar Rivers. The name Tuscarora means hemp gatherers. The Indians used hemp to make rope and binding cord. The Tuscarora were kin to the famous Iroquois Nation of New York and possibly came south in the 1400s. One Iroquois chief said of the Tuscarora, "They were of us and went from us long ago." One early explorer noted that the Tuscarora had flat bodies. Tuscarora children were laced down hard to a board in their infancy to give them the correct form of posture later. They ended up with exceedingly well-shaped limbs. One English explorer claimed their legs and feet were the handsomest in the world. The Cherokee. The Cherokee are the best-known Indian group in North Carolina history, both for their size and their location. Originally, the ancestors of the Cherokee lived around the Ohio River. Like the Tuscarora, they were kin to the Iroquois. The Cherokee, however, did not have the same good relations with their northern kinfolk that the Tuscarora had. The Cherokee had been driven from their original homes after long years of fighting with the Iroquois. The Cherokee first settled in the deep mountains during the height of the woodland period. Like the Catawba, the Cherokee called themselves another name, Yunwiya, the people or the principal people. The word Cherokee may be a variation of a Mississippian word for people who live in caves, a reference to their mountain homes. When Europeans first arrived, the Cherokee controlled a mountain region of 40,000 square miles, including parts of western North Carolina, eastern Tennessee, northern Alabama and Georgia, and western Virginia. They would later be considered one of the five civilized tribes of the Southeast, along with the Chickasaw, Creek, Choctaw, and Seminole. The Cherokee were one of the largest tribes in what became the United States. They may have numbered more than 30,000 during the late woodland period. The villages on the Savannah River in South Carolina and Georgia were home to the Lower Cherokee. Those in the Tennessee River Valley in what became the state of Tennessee belonged to the Upper Cherokee. The most important villages, in terms of size and prestige, were often located among the Middle Cherokee. These villages were concentrated on the Little Tennessee River in the very western part of North Carolina. One, Nickwassee, was located at the present site of the town of Franklin and was a ceremonial center similar to Town Creek. Disputes within the Cherokee community could be resolved by discussions at this sacred town. Each of the three principal groups spoke a different dialect, a variation in the pronunciation of words, of the Cherokee language. The Cherokee lacked clay to make much pottery. Instead, they stored many items in woven baskets made of green strips of tender branches, often from oak trees. Through the centuries, Cherokee baskets have been some of the most beautiful works of art made by North Carolinians. Native American habits and beliefs. The woodland culture had become so common by the 1500s that the tribes shared many beliefs, habits, and customs. For example, all tribes hunted, with deer being the most valuable prey, both for its meat and its skin. All depended upon the same products from the forest, including grapes and berries, in season, and nuts like chestnuts, black walnuts, and hickories. Often, natives would supplement their diets during the cold depths of winter by finding holes in trees where squirrels had hidden their supplies. If they could catch the squirrel as well, they ate it too. All tribes planted the Three Sisters, corn, beans, and squash, all of which were dried and preserved. The vegetables balanced the natives' diet in winter when game was scarce. Algonquin groups, for example, mixed corn and beans with meat and grease for a dish they called succotash. Today, a variation on that meal, Brunswick stew, is served in barbecue restaurants across the state. Village life. Village life was the norm for all Native American groups by this time. The coastal tribes often built bark longhouses, but the more common form of shelter was a wattle and daub hut. For this, tree branches were bent from one side of the hut to the other. Smaller green vines or twigs were woven like cloth among the larger branches. The family then filled in the air spaces with wet clay. The structure had the advantage that, if it fell down or burned, it could be as easily replaced as repaired. Because their climate was the coldest, the Cherokee often had two houses for each family group, a sturdy one in winter and an open-air one in summer. Each village followed rules and customs that helped individuals find their way through life and have a sense of belonging and accomplishment. Because a growing population meant competition for resources, most villages had palisades around them to keep out bears, wolves, and attackers from other tribes. Woodland Indians established their kinship ties through the women of the tribe. All children belonged to the clan, an extended family of people with a common ancestor, of their mothers. Today, we call this a matrilineal society, where the family line is traced through the matri, or mother. Children were raised by members of the mother's family. The grandmother had great influence over all her grandchildren. Uncles acted almost like fathers to the boys of the group. The father, by rule, came from another clan to ensure the physical diversity of the tribe. When a man married, he came to live in the household of his mother-in-law. He might be kind and loving to his children, but he actually had duties back in his own mother's house, where he was an uncle to young members of his own clan. The woodland culture divided work up fairly cleanly between men and women. Men helped clear the ground in the spring for planting, but women owned the seeds and planted and nurtured them. Men spent long periods hunting, usually after planting and after the harvest. The men groomed their hunting areas with the same care that women did their gardens. For example, every year, Catawba men burned off their best hunting grounds across the Piedmont so they could see their prey. This kept much of the Piedmont a grassy savanna land for hundreds of years. Most tribes governed by consensus, meaning they discussed their problems until almost everyone agreed to the same action. Older men and women were often consulted in major decisions, and it was considered very impolite to interrupt elders until they were completely finished talking. Often, tribes had two different sets of leaders, one who governed in peacetime, and another whose role was to lead the tribe in warfare. Special feature, growing up, Cherokee. According to Cherokee tradition, just as there are four seasons in a year, so a person goes through four stages of life. Being in the womb is the first, childhood is the second, family is the third, and being an elder is the last. Childhood, then, was part of the natural order of things. All Cherokee children identified with the extended family of their mother. Cherokee organized their society around kin groups called clans. A Cherokee's identity was determined by his or her mother's mother. The maternal grandmother organized food and shelter and made sure that all of her grandchildren were properly cared for and taught respect and duty. A council of grandmothers ruled each village. Their word was law, and no one easily crossed them. Cherokee children followed clearly stated rules. Girls learned valuable lessons from their mothers, grandmothers, and aunts who lived within the clan. Boys learned about being a man from their mother's brothers, in other words, their maternal uncles. A father in Cherokee society had an important position as a provider and protector of the village, but he shared the training of his children with the mother's brothers. For example, a boy often learned how to kill each type of animal from an uncle. The lesson included teaching respect for the spirit of the prey, because the Cherokee believed that all living things had a spirit shared through the whole world, and to disturb the spirit would be unhealthy for both the individual and the whole clan. Both boys and girls were expected to learn about the traditions of their clan. Each Cherokee clan had a name that explained its function in the greater nation. For example, the Long Hair Clan, also known as the Twister Clan because of the braids the grandmothers wore, were the keepers of religious traditions taught through dance and song. The Deer Clan taught boys to be hunters and tanners, and each boy learned which parts of the deer's insides could be used as medicine. Members of the Blue Holly Clan kept special mixtures to cure children, which they had gathered from plants in the woods. Each Cherokee child came to understand how interdependent the whole village was. One person's skill, taught to him or her by the elders, could save and sustain others. Both boys and girls changed their behavior when they became teenagers. When a girl reached puberty, her hair was twisted and braided in a certain way to announce the event. Boys passed into manhood when they were able to demonstrate that they could use the skills taught them by their uncles. This involved survival in the woods and their first successful hunt. When it was time to become an adult, one had to find a companion outside the clan. Every boy and girl had to seek the permission of the grandmothers to be together. If a boy wanted a girl to marry him, he went out and killed a deer, following the sacred habits that respected its spirit. He brought the meat to the girl at the home of her parents. If she cooked it, they became engaged. The day of the wedding, the young man built a fire in the woods and asked his clansmen to join him. When the fire died down, he bid his friends farewell and took the embers to the sacred circle, where the priest used them to start the marriage fire. During the same time, the bride bathed and dressed her hair with corn pollen to make the marriage fertile. When the marriage fire was ready, the couple approached from opposite sides. After the two clans present exchanged gifts, the couple entered the sacred circle, and the priest announced to all the guests and spirits present that Nigo-di-ski-si-di continued. The Cherokee phrase is loosely translated, "This is the way it is." The newly married couple then moved into the house of the bride's mother, and the cycle of village life continued. Belief systems. All Native Americans respected nature as much as they did their elders. They knew that their very survival depended upon their interaction with the environment. In many ways, their religion was about nature. At the core of their beliefs was a reverence for the spiritual qualities of all things, from rocks to plants to animals to the very sky above. Native Americans believed a spirit could be found in all things. A hunter, for example, would pray for forgiveness to the spirit of a deer just before he killed it, to help the spirit escape the animal and find a home elsewhere in the natural order. A conjurer might ask the wind to spread the heat of a sick person's fever into the nearby woods, giving the patient relief. Participants in the booger dance wore fearsome masks made from a variety of natural materials. The whole design used the spirit of each ingredient like a compound to ward off any evil that had come into the village. All Native Americans repeated stories to gain an understanding of how nature worked. The stories often involved monsters and beasts, much the way Europeans told fairy tales about strange things that happened in the woods. The Cherokee, for example, said that both hunting and farming came from the cave where Kanati the hunter and his wife Silu Cornwoman lived. Kanati hunted by letting one animal at a time out of the cave and then killing it. Silu hoarded all the seeds deep inside the cave and everyone went hungry. One day, the little people, who lived under rocks and roots, came and killed Kanati and Silu. They let the animals out and spilled the blood of Kanati and Silu on the ground, which freed the animals and seeds for others to use. The Cherokee believed that the little people could help them in times of trouble. During one battle at Niguasi, it is said the little people came flying out of a burial mound and defeated the invaders. Another time, a white minister reported he saw the little people flying around Chimney Rock, the famous granite spire in the mountains. The Cherokee respected the mountains around them and believed that they struggled against the powers living on the ridges. In a cave in a river bend near today's Fontana Lake live Uktina, a huge serpent with horns who shook the earth as he slithered. On the mountaintop above lived Tlanua, a great hawk, larger than any who lives now, who was said to be very strong and very savage. These fearsome creatures kept people from living their daily lives until some wise medicine men stole hawk eggs from the nest and fed them to the giant snake. The two animals then fought each other and left the people alone. The Columbian Exchange. When Europeans arrived in the 1500s, the tribes were doing well, but the meeting of the Native Americans and the Europeans brought drastic changes to both. People, ideas, and goods from Europe were brought to the Americas. Whether from trade or warfare, things were taken from the Americas to Europe too. This exchange of plants, animals, foods, people, diseases, and ideas between the Old World and the New World was called the Columbian Exchange. The Europeans, for instance, brought with them animals such as horses, pigs, sheep, goats, and chickens, and traded them to the native people. The natives, in turn, traded various birds and small animals, one of which was the turkey. Plants native to the Americas included corn, potatoes, beans, cacao, chocolate, tomatoes, and peppers. The Europeans brought beets, rice, peaches, coffee, and oats. Europeans also brought something that was far deadlier to the Indians: diseases. The Native Americans had never been exposed to these diseases, so their bodies had no immunity or resistance. The most deadly diseases were smallpox, measles, chickenpox, and influenza. Soon, disease and warfare with the Europeans decreased the Native American population. The entire population of some Caribbean islands was wiped out by these new diseases. Within 100 years of first contact with the Europeans, it is estimated that the number of Native Americans in the Carolinas was reduced by half. Special feature, Carolina places, Lake Matamuskete. Matamuskete is more than just the largest natural body of fresh water in North Carolina. The lake, which stretches 18 miles east to west and 6 miles north to south, is also one of the shallowest lakes around. Long before Europeans arrived, the lake fascinated the first Native Americans. The name of the lake is Algonquin for dry dust. That must mean that during long-ago droughts, the wetland dried up. An Algonquin tradition even suggests how the water got in the lake. At a time long before Columbus, the people lived happily in harmony with nature. Then a drought lingered for several years, and the people and animals almost starved. The people decided to build a great bonfire with all the dry wood they had. They hoped the brightness of the fire would attract the attention of the Great Spirit. It did, but something must have been wrong with the people. A great wind blew the fire out of control, and it caught in the nearby dried-out woods. It burned great holes in the ground for more than a year. To save themselves, the people offered to sacrifice the strongest young brave. At the critical moment, a beautiful maiden threw herself in front of the executioners and prayed to the rain gods to save her beloved and the rest of the people. The people looked up and saw a shooting star. Soon, rain followed for days on end. The fires were put out, and the lake filled with water, and the people were rescued. Lake Matamuskete may well have been created by fire, although romance likely had little to do with it. The earth under the lake is peat, which will burn when it is dry. It is possible that lightning started a fire that burned for a long while and carved out the shallow saucer that later filled with water. In the early 1800s, some state leaders wondered if draining the lake would open up some of the richest soil around. Draining it, however, was a problem, for the bottom of the lake is actually 3 feet below sea level. Once steam-powered engines came along, the idea was renewed. In 1915, the New Holland Company built the world's largest set of pumps to get rid of the water. The four machines could take out more than 1 million gallons of water a minute. To keep new water from seeping in, hundreds of miles of canals were dug in all directions. In 1925, the company built a new town called New Holland on the dried lake bed to house hundreds of workers to grow the crops. In 1928, the New Holland families grew a variety of crops that had the best yields in state history. The achievement gained widespread attention. One agricultural scientist said the lake bed was the finest farmland in the world. Then, in 1932, one of the great disasters in state history occurred. The pumps failed after a huge rainstorm. The lake began to fill up again with floodwaters. The mud was knee-deep in places. The lake filled in, covering much of the town. In 1934, the federal government bought the property to return it to the birds. The refilled Matamuskete has been a wildlife refuge for more than 70 years. Almost one-fifth of all the migratory birds that fly over the eastern United States stop each fall at Matamuskete. They fatten up for winter on the abundance of fish in the lake. The old pumping station was for years used as a hunting lodge. The lodge and its tall observation tower, which resembles a lighthouse, have survived into the 21st century.